Thank you very much indeed, Catherine, and thank you and the Human Rights Commission for the invitation to come speak to you all this afternoon. An invitation I'm extremely pleased to take up and very flattered to receive. We in the UK are currently having a parallel debate, a debate similar to the debate that you're having, albeit starting with the Human Rights Act. But just as you embark on your national human rights consultation, we are engaged in a debate in the United Kingdom about whether we should replace the Human Rights Act, or build on the Human Rights Act, I probably should say, with a British Bill of Rights, which may perhaps in some respects go further than our Human Rights Act in relation to the the scope of the rights which are protected, gives an opportunity perhaps to improve on the institutional mechanisms which we have in our Human Rights Act for the protection of the rights and values which the people of the UK consider to be fundamental. So what's going on here is of enormous interest to me. And Catherine mentioned the Joint Committee on Human Rights recently published a report last summer on the British Bill of Rights debate. And I'm pleased to report to you that the Australian example, both at state level and now at national level, in terms of the process which has been established to have a proper community consultation to find out what rights should be in any federal charter and what the mechanism should be, has been held up by the Joint Committee on Human Rights to the UK government as a model of a process which should be followed. So we are very interested in what's going on here. I've learned a great deal on my short visit talking to people about your process, which I will take back with me. I'm not sure of the prospects of persuading the UK government that the Australian process should be followed. At the moment, they're rather reluctant. And you'll see from a recent report of the Joint Committee where we tried to prod them again in this direction, your national process having started since our last report, their latest thinking on this is that they're not really sure about having an independent committee look into this. They'd rather keep control of it themselves. So I'm not sure we're going to have much success in persuading them that they should follow your process, but that won't stop the Joint Committee on Human Rights trying to persuade them that they should. Now, what I'm really here to talk to you about this afternoon, can everyone hear me at the back, by the way, am I? Good. Is not really at all about the process, from which we have more to learn from you, I think, nor is it about what rights should be protected in any Bill of Rights or Federal Charter of Rights. It's more to do with the model and the respective roles, in particular, of the main institutional players, the courts, the executive and the legislature, in any model of rights protection in a modern democracy. So that's really the question that I want to focus on. What is the appropriate model of human rights protection in a modern democracy? And that's a subject that I believe very strongly is one which is capable of commanding very considerable cross-community consensus in any democratic society. And I also have a very strong conviction that if one can achieve consensus about the detail of the model which one follows in protecting human rights, then you don't need to reach definitive consensus on the scope of the rights that are the precise scope of the rights that are to be protected, or the precise limitations that those rights can be subject to. So the question of the model which one wants is in some senses a prior model, and it's a very important model, and I think it's extremely important to invest a lot of energy in securing consensus about the type of model which one wants to build one's human rights protection system on. So my starting point really is that bills of rights shouldn't really be seen as putting a stop definitively and forever to political debate and disagreement about the interpretation and the scope of fundamental rights. I think that's a very important starting point in any discussion and debate about human rights. And if we can design models which preserve, albeit within limits, spaces which are meaningful for political actors and representative politicians, democratically elected decision makers, to still have ongoing disagreements and debates about the meaning of those rights, then we're much more likely to achieve a satisfactory and long-lasting instrument for human rights protection. I want to start really with, I suppose, a sort of grumble about the state of debates about bills of rights. Because in my view, they've become rather hobbled over the years by what I regard as a bit of a forced dichotomy, really, between judicial models of human rights protection on the one hand and so-called legislative models of human rights protection on the other. Traditionally, most advocates of bills of rights have advocated what I'm describing as a judicial model of human rights protection, in which courts are elevated above democratically elected decision makers, including legislatures, as the definitive interpreters of the meaning of the rights which are protected, complete usually with the power to strike down all decisions, including decisions by Parliament, including legislation, if they're incompatible with the court's interpretation of those rights. And we're all familiar with the best known models, the best known examples of that kind of judicial model, the United States Bill of Rights, the German Basic Law, and other constitutions throughout the world, which really follow that sort of judicial model. But in more recent years, there's emerged a very considerable literature, academic literature, exploring the possibilities of legislative as opposed to judicial models of human rights protection, in which it's the legislature, the parliament, which carries out the scrutinising of laws for compatibility with the fundamental rights contained in the Charter or the Bill of Rights. Now, the earliest sustained accounts that I'm aware of such a legislative model came from David Kinley in 1993. David Kinley's at Our Loss and Your Gain. You're all probably familiar with David. He wrote a book called The European Convention on Human Rights Compliance Without Incorporation, which was an attempt to break through the stalemate in the UK about whether there should be a Human Rights Act or a Human Rights Bill by focusing on the systems that there could be for the Parliament scrutinising legislation for compatibility with European Convention rights. And since that time, there's been a burgeoning interest in the idea of legislative models of rights protection. We've got Mark Tushnet in America arguing that the Constitution should be taken away from the courts, Jeremy Waldron mounting a sustained attack on judicial review, arguing that human rights are much better protected by legislatures but rather than courts. In Canada, a political scientist, Janet Hebert, has also very persuasively and extensively argued for recognition of a distinctive parliamentary model of rights protection. And indeed, many of the contributions to this debate have come from Australian scholars. Tom Campbell, Geoffrey Goldsworthy and Adrian Stone, also arguing consistently in favour of the protection of human rights through the development of legislative mechanisms and parliamentary mechanisms and processes rather than the courts. Now, for a number of those authors, and I should say in practice as well, of course, Australia is probably the best exemplar of those thoughts and theories about legislative protection of human rights being actually put into practice with the Victorian Charter of Rights and Responsibilities and the ACT Human Rights Act. For many of the writers promoting legislative models of human rights protection, the attraction of parliamentary scrutiny is that it's an alternative to judicial review for human rights compatibility. It keeps consideration of compatibility questions in the forum of the legislature, which is the only democratically legitimate forum for that scrutiny for compatibility to take place, and therefore it keeps away from the undemocratic courts any risk of them making illegitimate, usurping decisions which ought to be for the democratic representatives. Now, that's a very understandable instinct, I think, to keep those decisions away from the courts, because as we all know, human rights are often deeply contested. They're framed in very broad and general terms. They're very abstract at the level at which they find their way into bills of rights. And what they mean in practice, in implementation, when we apply them to particular disputes, which are the stuff of everyday politics, is often very, very contested and deeply divisive. So the attraction of a legislative model is that it preserves that contestation and that scope for disagreement to the democratic sphere. And there are very good democratic theoretical reasons. There are also very good institutional reasons for those contests to take place in parliaments rather than courts, in terms of the capacity of parliaments to make the necessary factual inquiries and call witnesses and so on. Courts are very much more constrained in terms of their institutional possibilities. It's also entirely understandable, given the historic predominance of the judicial supremacy models of rights protection. But my thought, which I wanted to start off on, is really that this dichotomy between judicial models on the one hand and purely legislative models on the other hand is really a false dichotomy. and that what we really need for the better protection of human rights in democratic societies such as ours is a system which gives a proper, meaningful role both to courts and to parliaments. And so the really tricky thing for any designer of a Bill of Rights or a constitution today, in my view, is how to set that system up in the first place in a way which recognises the legitimacy of both branches having a role, which also recognises the importance of the executive making informed decisions about the effect of their decisions on human rights, and which sets up the institutional relationships in a way which makes sure that we neither veer towards judicial supremacy nor do we veer towards sole legislative scrutiny for compatibility. So my view is that we need both courts and we need parliament, and they both have to be given a role in any modern Bill of Rights in a democracy. What we really need is the institutional basis on which to build a human rights culture in the sense of a culture of justification. And what I mean by a culture of justification is a culture in which every exercise of power, whether it's by public organisations or private concentrations of power, which interferes with fundamental rights and interests and values that we as societies hold dear, must be transparently and publicly justified by the decision maker exercising that power. And there must be opportunities for that justification, that public justification, to be publicly scrutinised, publicly analysed, and tested for its worth, for its factual basis, for its cogency, tested in public. And the way to do that is both to do it in the parliamentary process and to do it in the judicial process. And so we need to set up our institutions in a way which allows opportunities for this scrutiny for justification of all decisions which can affect fundamental interests. So that's my starting point. A culture of human rights which is a culture of justification and an acceptance of a role for both Parliament and for courts. Now, in that universe that I've briefly sketched out, parliamentary human rights committees have a fairly significant role, in my view. Now, of course, at one level I would say that, wouldn't I? It's very self-justificatory, what I get out of bed in the morning to do. But if Parliament is to take seriously and properly perform its scrutinising role of legislation and its scrutinising of everything which the government does, which has human rights implications, properly, it needs to be properly informed. And human rights committees are the way in which, so far, parliaments have attempted to do this, by allowing some members of the legislature to develop an expertise in the subject matter of human rights, assisted by, but not governed by, independent professional legal advice to give them the guidance and the framework within which they must make their decisions. And Parliament can then perform its important role in such a Bill of Rights with proper help of a parliamentary committee. And what I want to try and show in the rest of what I've got to say this afternoon is how, if we get it right, a Bill of Rights, far from undermining Parliament or hollowing out politics or being anti-democratic, actually gives us enormous opportunities to enhance the role of politicians and political representatives and political democratic institutions to engage with human rights, to discuss what human rights mean in practice, to promote and further the achievement of human rights. It's by that engagement in the long term by politicians that the cause of promoting and protecting, further fulfilling human rights is most likely to be advanced. So that is really my argument, I suppose, this afternoon, that there is an opportunity in designing a Bill of Rights to create a system in which politicians are drawn in to be involved in human rights. And it's quite the opposite of the conventional assumption that shifting from a parliamentary sovereignty-based model in which there is no fundamental law of human rights inevitably leads to the neutering of politics and the hollowing out of democratic and political activity. And I want to try and demonstrate that to you by largely by talking about the work of the Joint Committee on Human Rights in the UK Parliament and demonstrating to you the range of the work that it does, and talking a little bit about the nature of that work to try and demonstrate how politicians are enabled to and facilitated to engage in human rights argument and debate. Now, the first important function of the Joint Committee on Human Rights in the UK Parliament under the Human Rights Act is legislative scrutiny, scrutinising bills to see whether they are compatible with the standards in the European Convention on Human Rights, which are given effect by the Human Rights Act. The Joint Committee on Human Rights also scrutinises legislation for compatibility with all other human rights norms to which the UK is a party, all the other unincorporated treaties, as well as the European Convention on Human Rights. But its scrutiny function is extremely important. And I just want to say a quick word about the range of that scrutiny function. The Joint Committee on Human Rights scrutinises government bills from the time that they are published. It also scrutinises statutory instruments on a fairly ad hoc basis if they raise significant human rights issues. It also scrutinises, to some extent, less perhaps than ideally we would like, pre-legislative documents, green papers, consultation documents, which are likely to turn into bills, so that there's an opportunity for some input by the committee at the earlier stage of policy formation. It also carries out scrutiny, post-legislative scrutiny, in relation to provisions where perhaps it's flagged up as the bill has gone through Parliament that there may be a human rights problem. Then the committee may come back and look at the operation of that particular provision in practice and see whether its concerns about compatibility at the time it was going through Parliament have actually been borne out in practice. So it does post-legislative scrutiny as well. But I want to say a word about what the committee does when it conducts legislative scrutiny. Because legislative scrutiny sounds to most non-lawyers, and perhaps to many lawyers as well, I don't know, like a very technical exercise. It sounds a bit like proofing legislation to make sure there aren't any technical errors in it. Now, it's very important for me to try and get across, it's far from a technical exercise. Scrutinising legislation for human rights compatibility is not an exercise which can be done by a lawyer sitting on their own with a set of law reports on the shelf at their desk and then produce a report at the end of it. What it involves is much, much more rooted in factual and policy questions than that. It requires identification of the necessary factual issues that may be at stake in deciding whether the law is compatible. It involves analysing the evidence which is provided by the government in response to questions about those facts. It may involve hearing a lot of evidence from NGOs, from civil society, about the impact that this measure is likely to have in practice. So, although there are, of course, certain things which human rights law means governments simply can't do, they can't deport people to torture, they can't detain people indefinitely without charge, they can't have secret criminal trials from which the public or the defendant or the lawyer are excluded. There are certain things which governments have to accept are simply beyond the parameters that human rights law permits. And occasionally it's the role of the committee in its scrutiny work to tell the government that. But more often than not, legislative scrutiny for compatibility involves the question of whether an interference with a right, which is not an absolute right, is a justified limitation. So, for example, whether a power which is given, which can be exercised in a way which interferes with somebody's privacy, or interferes with somebody's free speech, is justified by a legitimate aim, and whether the effect it's going to have on that interest, speech or privacy, isn't disproportionate. Now, that is quintessentially the sort of balancing and weighing exercise which politicians are very used to doing. And the role of a human rights committee and the advisers advising a human rights committee is to make sure that that discussions about those sorts of measures take place within, situated firmly within the human rights law framework. So the committee can guide Parliament as to how it should go about having the debate about whether an interference with free speech or with privacy is a justifiable interference. There's an enormous scope left for politicians to have that argument. Human rights law may rule out certain options, but there is within the scope of most of the rights which are protected by the Human Rights Act room for disagreement between politicians and outcomes which are perfectly compatible a range of possible outcomes which are perfectly compatible with the right itself. And that, again, is an important and quite liberating realisation. And I think an awful lot of people who argue against bills of rights or statutory bills of rights don't start from that appreciation that there is still, when politicians are debating laws, enormous scope for them to have argument about whether an interference with a fundamental right is a permissible one, it's a justifiable one. And it's not a question for lawyers, that's the most important thing. It's not one where you just say, put it over to the lawyers, we'll get a memo back which says you can or you can't do it. The point is, it's a question for the politicians, guided properly by the framework which they're advised on by the lawyers. So there's enormous scope in most of the legislative scrutiny work for politicians to have a very active role. So to give a few examples, perhaps, just to make it perhaps more real for you, some of the arguments that we've had in the UK Parliament over the last year or two have been over whether, for example, the right to liberty in the European Convention on Human Rights prevents the government from introducing 42-day pre-charge detention. Now, that's not an issue which you can say, ask the lawyers, can you do it or can't you do it? It's quite a complicated issue which depends on the adequacy of various safeguards, the availability of various alternatives. It's an issue on which there needs to be quite extensive inquiry by the Parliament into the efficacy of those alternatives and whether or not the safeguards are going to work in practice. It's an issue, in other words, where there's lots of scope for political debate, guided, as I say, by the framework. Does the right to a fair hearing in Article 6 of the European Convention require a person who's subjected to a control order always to be provided with, at the very least, the gist of the material that's relied on against them? Are they entitled to know at least the substance of the allegations which are rooted in intelligence material when they're subjected to the very severe restrictions of liberty which control orders impose on people? Again, a lot of scope there for political argument and disagreement within the framework. Does the prohibition on inhuman and degrading treatment mean that smacking children should be outlawed, should be a criminal offence? Human rights law doesn't provide a straightforward yes or no answer. It provides some guidance, but it doesn't provide a straightforward answer. It poses a lot of factual questions which politicians, if conscientious, should inquire into before reaching a view. Should faith schools be allowed to discriminate on religious grounds in their admissions policy, for example? These are all questions where human rights law simply doesn't say yes or no. They're complicated questions, and there's enormous scope for political debate. Now, one other aspect of the nature of scrutiny I'd like to draw attention to is that scrutiny for human rights compatibility, as conducted by the JCHR, and as should be conducted, in my view, by any human rights legislative committee, is scrutiny in a very broad sense. It's not just negative scrutiny for compliance. It's not just looking to see whether the government should be told you can't do that in this bill. An enormous amount of human rights law involves positive obligations, obligations on the state to actually take some steps, to do something to prevent people from falling into destitution, for example. Or it involves things which may be less than obligations, but which are commitments to aspirations, which can be realised over a long period. Now, the Human Rights Committee, in its scrutiny of government bills, is always looking for opportunities to fulfil positive obligations on the United Kingdom, imposed by its human rights obligations, or to take a step which would progressively realise a commitment which the UK has committed itself to, for example, in the Economic and Social Rights Covenant. So this positive dimension of human rights scrutiny, looking for opportunities to achieve positive obligations and to fulfil aspirations, is also an important part of legislative scrutiny. Other important aspects of the legislative scrutiny process, which are crucial to countering the assertion that bills of rights are anti-democratic, are the opportunities it affords for civil society and NGOs to get involved in the legislative process. We receive submissions from NGOs on bills. We post up on our website what bills we are scrutinising, the issues that we're pursuing with the government in correspondence. We call actively for information, submissions from the people on the front line who know much more than we do about the effect this piece of legislation is going to have on the people who are affected. And we're massively assisted. In fact, we depend to a large extent on being alerted by those people working on the front line. And that's an important opportunity for NGOs to actually participate and engage with the political process. And although it's been quite a slow process, we're getting more successful, I think, at the JCHR in actually engaging a wide range of civil society in the legislative process by making submissions to the JCHR. The transparency of the process is another important democratic feature of it. We correspond with the department which is promoting the bill. We identify the questions that the government needs to answer to satisfy the committee of its compatibility, and the government responds by letter. And those letters then get published as appendices to the JCHR's reports analysing the government's position. So it's all out in the open, it's all publicly there. It's all there for parliamentarians to rely on in debates about the bill, and it's all there for members of the public to use as a resource once the bill becomes law. Okay, so that's legislative scrutiny. Now, another very important strand of the committee's work, which I think it's important to understand when considering whether bills of rights are inherently anti-democratic, concerns Parliament's response to court judgments concerning human rights. Now, an important feature of our Human Rights Act, and it's also a feature of the Victorian Charter, and it will be very much a question of debate whether it should be in any federal charter, is that courts can't, under those instruments, strike down legislation. The most they can do is give a declaration of incompatibility. Now, what happens when a court is given a declaration of incompatibility is very important in terms of appreciating the democratic opportunities in a Bill of Rights. It's then back in Parliament's court to decide what to do about that declaration of incompatibility. The structure of the Act preserves the government's possibility, an opportunity for the government, to decide that it disagrees with the interpretation of the courts and that actually it thinks it's not compatible. The UK government under the Human Rights Act has never actually done that, but it's a theoretical possibility. And the JCHR, if the government ever were to do that, would be able to scrutinise the government's reasons for saying it disagrees with the court's interpretation of compatibility. If it agrees with the court's interpretation that there's a compatibility problem with the law, then there's a big discussion to be had, usually, about what the government should do about it, what Parliament should do about it, to amend the law or change the policy or the practice for the future, to make sure it doesn't happen again and to avoid repetition. And at that point, there's a very important role for Parliament to play in scrutinising the government's proposals for amending the law in the light of the judgment, or amending its policy or its practice or regulations or whatever. And in a series of reports, the Joint Committee on Human Rights has published its correspondence with the government following human rights judgments, both by the Strasbourg Court, the European Court of Human Rights, and domestic courts giving declarations of incompatibility, where it has followed up the judgment with the government to keep the pressure on to make sure that there's a swift response, but also to scrutinise the government's reasons in relation to that judgment and what it's going to do, and sometimes making suggestions about the general measures which the government should introduce in response to the judgment. So again, there's an enormous opportunity for politicians, a very important opportunity for politicians to be involved in a central question which, in the absence of a human rights structure such as that, would be decided effectively by the courts and then by the government simply implementing what the courts require. Just in passing, it may be of interest to you to know that the number of declarations of incompatibility that have actually been given by UK courts under the Human Rights Act is surprisingly small. Since 2000, when the Act came into force, about 26 declarations of incompatibility have given, of which only 17 have become final declarations. The others were appealed against successfully. And in relation to those, the government has taken action to respond in nearly all cases, and the ones it hasn't taken action in yet, it's consulting on. So there's always been an opportunity in relation to those 17 declarations of incompatibility for Parliament to be involved in the discussion. And the Joint Committee tends to report on what the government's doing to respond. Okay, very quickly, other strands of the Joint Committee on Human Rights work, in addition to its scrutiny work, legislative scrutiny work, and to its work on court judgments, all of which facilitate parliamentarians' involvement and engagement with human rights. It conducts thematic inquiries into specific topics where there may be cause for human rights concern. It tries to do so in a way which doesn't duplicate what other investigating bodies such as human rights commissions are doing, And it also tries to do so in a way which demonstrates to the public that human rights are about more than the things they read about in the newspapers, about suspected terrorist rights and criminal accused rights. So, for example, the Joint Committee has done inquiries and published reports, made recommendations about older people in healthcare settings and their human rights, the human rights of adults with learning disabilities. We did a report on the use of restraint on juveniles in secure training centre settings. We did our report on a Bill of Rights for the UK. We're doing one currently on policing and protest. We've got an inquiry coming up on business and human rights and the responsibility of business organisations to respect human rights. And we've got an ongoing inquiry which has reported many, many times on counter-terrorism policy and human rights, which takes counter-terrorism policy as the theme and scrutinises everything, every proposal which the government makes against human rights standards. Other aspects of the committee's work, which give these opportunities for politicians to engage with human rights, the committee monitors implementation of the Human Rights Act. One of the problems in implementing the Human Rights Act in the UK has been the court's very restrictive interpretation of the definition of public authority. The scope of the Act was deliberately widely drawn to make sure that private contractors contracting with public bodies providing public services, as is increasingly the case, were covered by the Human Rights Act. That provision has been interpreted very restrictively and narrowly by the courts up to the House of Lords, in a way which means that those private contractors are no longer within the scope of the Human Rights Act. So the scope of the Act has been whittled down very significantly. So a person in a residential care home run by a local authority directly is in a better position in terms of their human rights protection than somebody who happens to be in a privately run home, even if their place in that privately run home is publicly paid for. And the committee's done a lot of work, including a lot of inquiry work, a lot of fact-finding, received a lot of submissions and reported several times on that question, recommending to the government that it amend the Human Rights Act to restore the original scope, its originally intended wider scope than the courts have given it. It monitors the work of the human rights institutions, the Children's Commissioners, the Human Rights Commissions in Northern Ireland, and our own UK Equality and Human Rights Commission. It monitors the government's human rights policy. We have regular sessions with the ministers responsible for human rights to ascertain what they're taking forward, what their position is in relation to various international treaties and so on. It also monitors constantly the UK's compliance with other international human rights treaties as well as the European Convention. Quite apart from its scrutiny work, it will take the most recent set of concluding observations of the relevant monitoring body and examine the extent to which the UK has done what it's recommended to do by the monitoring body. And it weaves those recommendations and that work into other aspects of its work. So, for example, when it's scrutinising a bill, it might make a recommendation to the government that it takes the opportunity to do something which the Committee on the Rights of the Child recommended ought to be done in relation to the law on juvenile restraint, for example. So, with an eye on the clock, the lesson really, I suppose, if I'm asked about lessons for Australia, the experience we've had with the Joint Committee on Human Rights in the UK is that the wide remit of the Joint Committee on Human Rights has enabled it to develop a whole series of lines of inquiry and work which have engaged politicians in what human rights means. And although there isn't any scientific, rigorous research yet done, to my regret, on whether this has improved parliamentarians' performance in terms of human rights, impressionistically, I think it's possible to say that the literacy of parliamentarians in human rights matters has increased significantly over the life of the Joint Committee. And the debate we had over the 42-day detention, pre-charge detention measure that was introduced in the last parliament, the last session, I should say, was noticeably better informed than the debate that took place 2 years previous to that about the proposal to increase it to 90 days. I think if one compares those two debates, the sophistication of members' appreciation of the human rights issues in play with that measure is very noticeably better in the later debate. So I'll leave you just with a few thoughts about where there may still be room, quite considerable room in my view, for improvement. If you have the luxury of drawing up your charter for the first time, how can one build, if one accepts the argument that one needs both courts and parliament to have serious legitimate roles in protecting human rights, and one needs parliamentarians to be assisted by a proper human rights committee, what lessons might there be in terms of how one could improve on the arrangements that that exist in the UK? Well, I've got a few suggestions which I'll just leave you with before opening up to discussion. I'm very interested to hear your views. The coverage of the legislative scrutiny work is very important. We haven't had the time or resources, nor does the committee itself really have the resources, given the time rather, given the scope of its work, to systematically scrutinise all statutory instruments. But increasingly legislation is skeletal in nature, and statutory instruments often contain very important provisions which have an impact on human rights. We ad hoc may scrutinise a particular provision which has come to our attention, but there are 3,000 a year. So there's no chance really of us systematically scrutinising those. So systematic scrutiny of statutory instruments as well as government bills would be very important in my view. And over time, systems can be developed which make it much less onerous. It doesn't involve... mechanisms are developed for filtering out the ones which are not likely to have human rights implications and so on. So it's not perhaps as onerous as it sounds. A very important improvement would be a requirement that there be reasoned statements of compatibility accompanying every bill to facilitate the parliamentary scrutiny. We get explanatory notes which vary enormously in the extent of the information we get explaining the human rights compatibility of the bill. Occasionally we get extremely detailed working showing their reasoning, supporting their conclusions that the provisions are compatible. If that accompanied every bill, legislative scrutiny would be much better conducted. Linked to that, really, we still don't have in the UK any well-established human rights impact assessment methodology which is accepted and applied by government departments. And I think, again, that's something which is developing in other European countries and in Scandinavian countries. And I think that would be beneficial to have some template for human rights impact assessment, which was more than simply a tick box exercise. I know there's great scepticism about impact assessment methodologies, and they can degenerate into mere tick box exercises. But given that governments have to explain and give reasons for compatibility of their bills, it really ought to be part of, embedded in the policy formation process, there ought to be a proper, rigorous, systematic approach by them to assessing the impact of the measure on human rights, which would include assessing opportunities for promoting and furthering human rights. We're considering... at the Joint Committee addressing this by drawing up some guidance for departments. In the absence of a dedicated human rights memorandum for us and in the absence of there being any impact assessment methodology, we're going to try and provide some guidance for departments about what we expect of them. But that's a poor substitute, really, in my view, for a full commitment to reason statements and accompanying impact assessments. In relation to certain rights which require progressive realisation by their nature rather than immediate realisation, it would be an enormous improvement on what we have in the UK Human Rights Act if a charter included programmatic duties to implement such rights, combined with various institutional mechanisms which made sure that that commitment was actually being implemented in practice. So reporting mechanisms, for example, to Parliament, independent review mechanisms, reporting to Parliament, opportunities for scrutiny and debate on those reports, and so on and so forth. In relation to judgments, requiring the government to report to Parliament on human rights judgments, so where there's a declaration of incompatibility, requiring the government within a fixed time frame, as in fact I think the Victorian Charter already does, would be an enormous improvement to actually require the government to bring something forward which can be scrutinised. In the UK, it all depends on us making enough of a nuisance of ourselves to get them to actually say something. There's no requirement that they come forward with a response with any timescale. Again, ways of bolstering Parliament's role, requiring the national human rights institutions, the commissions, to report directly to Parliament, to enhance their accountability to Parliament rather than to the government and enhance their independence. To have independent reviews of the implementation of the Bill of Rights or the Charter. We, in the UK, learnt this lesson the hard way. There's no mechanism for it. And it was only in 2006, when there was a bit of a crisis of public confidence provoked by a lot of very scaremongering newspaper stories about what the Human Rights Act was doing that prompted the government to hold a review of the implementation of the Human Rights Act, which was produced in 2006. But a regular review, preferably independently conducted, would be a great improvement. Departmental plans requiring them to address human rights in relation to that particular department's remit, possibly a human rights action plan at the government level, bringing together the various departmental inputs. There's scope in all sorts of ways for enhancing parliamentary involvement in human rights. And the most important thing I would say, is to have a parliamentary human rights committee with a wide enough remit to be able to engage in work across all these fronts, because that's what really helps to facilitate parliamentarians' engagement with human rights and to encourage genuine democratic debate about human rights. So I will leave it there, and I look forward to hearing your views and questions.